Chapter 22. Standing at the Crossroads of My Mind. Well, my foot is sore as all heck and still oozing red like a squashed jammy doughnut. Along with the backshawl fiasco, the injury has cost me a whole heap of time. With my shoes back on, that was a fun 20 minutes, I arrive at the port. It is shut. Or to use boating parlance, she is shut. Or to use pirate parlance, she be shut. The last ferry of the day taking pedestrians over the water to Gravesend has already left. As luck would have it, I'm able to hitch a lift over in a coracle. Truth be told, it's not a coracle at all. It's a small fishing boat. I've always wanted to go in a coracle, and that's why I fibbed. It's getting late in Gravesend, as it is everywhere in the UK's time zone, and with the local B&Bs either closed or full or terrible, I've got a problem on my hands. And it's not just on my hands. Sleep is a requirement for the whole body. With my mood now as black as an NHS filling, I switch from walking to trudging. I pass along a main road, through an industrial estate, under a bridge, and into a small park. I stop and look up at the star-spattered sky. I can't remember the names of the constellations, but I'm pretty sure one's named after a ride at Alton Towers. Suddenly three bullet points flash into my mind, and I'm pleased to see that my brain has ignored the default bullet, a simple black dot, and picked a slightly more stylish one, presumably by going to format, then bullets and numbering. But I also note, and this is perhaps more important, that the list offers a neat summary of my current mental state. You don't know where you are, you don't know what you're doing, you don't have any ham left. I dwell on this for a moment, and then, in what I must emphasize is a totally unsexual way, begin to lick out the empty ham packet. The few remaining drops of meat sweat, no match for the heft and power of my tongue. The hit of the saline briefly lifts my spirits. Of course it does, how could it not? But then the content of the first two bullets comes to me again in the form of three additional bullets. It's true you don't know where you are. It's true you don't know what you're doing. And let me add something else. You feel isolated and alone. This is how I feel. I long for the familiarity of home, the comfort of my own bed, and, as I say, a bit of ham wouldn't go amiss either. I mean, what the hell am I doing here? Trudging the historic route of my forefather? For what? Using my eyes, I look round the park. It's empty save for a single unhomed man sitting on a bench. Another day in paradise, I say to myself, pleased that the Phil Collins reference has come to me easily. I want to think about Collins more, a lot more. But the elderly vagrant waves to me. Jesus, I think, not now. The last time I was cornered by a tramp in a park, he tried to rope me into a pyramid scheme, where you find 10 people to sell loose cigarettes and then find 10 people, and, well, I don't remember the details, but it sounded on paper like absolute guff. But still, this man is waving. Because he's homeless, I'm immediately scared. No, thank you, I say.
I wasn't asking you anything.
Pardon?
I said I wasn't asking you anything. There was no question to say no to. So why are you waving?
He shrugs.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
Ipswich, I suggest. The man laughs a throaty laugh, like his gullet needed a visit from Dinah Rod. It seems a bit weird that I just did a music reference, Collins, and now he's done one too, Beatles. But I guess it's a free country, so he's well within his rights. As a person, he's exceptionally unkempt. One side of his hair has started to form a single dreadlock, while the other is lank and fine. It's as if he's a pair of Siamese twins joined at the hairstyle. Yet something compels me to approach. If he tries anything funny, I know I can always slap him in the face, but to my surprise, his features soften. I don't mean he's melting. I just mean he now wears a kindly expression.
"Everything all right?" he says.
He has a friendly voice, and it's a pleasant surprise to meet a homeless person who isn't from Glasgow. I plonk myself down next to him, though obviously not right next to him.
"Well, you know Steve Backshall," I begin.
"Nope."
"That figures."
"Doesn't matter," I say, and he hands me his bottle of sherry.
"Here, looks like you need it."
I'm a little thrown by this vagrant. He seems so normal. Pyramid scheme man had a way of saying, "I know not," and using the word for instead of because, which made him sound like a character from Lord of the Rings or that TV series with boobs and dragons. I bet he was called something like Arador or Gondol. But this guy...
"I'm Brian, by the way. Hello, Brian. I'm Alan Partridge."
Well, I almost spit out my sherry. I had no idea I had a following in the homeless community. I'm angry at myself for being so judgmental. Just because he's homeless doesn't mean he's not capable of standing outside Curry's and looking in at the TVs. Brian had been aware of my career from way back in the 90s, when I was a sports presenter on the hard-hitting news programme The Day Today. He claims I once did an interview at a racetrack in which I mistook a jockey for a child, and while I have no memory of this and doubt he's got it right, I'm touched by his enthusiasm for my canon. Footnote, not a euphemism.
"So what brings you here, Alan?"
"Doing walk in footsteps of father," I answer. The phrasing's a bit weird, but I think it might be because of the bullet point thing earlier. I tell him about the box I found in my attic, about how I'd been so certain until then that my dad was a no-good idiot, and now...
"And now the kaleidoscope's been shaken," he says. "The pieces are in flux. I get that. It's disorientating."
And now here I am in a park, going nowhere. I'm going absolutely no... He silences me by putting his fingers to my lips. They smell of cigarettes and beef crisps.
"Nowhere," he says, shaking his head. "Sounds to me like you've got a purpose, Alan. And purpose goes a long way."
God, this guy's good. I take another swig of sherry. God, this sherry's good. It's like sherry trifle, but without the trifle. He's right, I do have a purpose. It's funny how it can be easier to share your most intimate feelings with complete strangers than with people closest to you. I once revealed to a woman on a plane that I was still wetting the bed when I was 18. It wasn't even true. I just felt the urge to confess something because she was a stranger. Footnote. Of course she didn't know this and later betrayed my confidence by posting it online where it's now widely regarded as fact. Every cloud has a silver lining, though, and 2 months ago I was delighted to accept the invitation to become a patron of the local incontinence charity. Conversely, I told my ex-wife Carol almost nothing. Well, not at the start. At the start I told her everything. At the start we were inseparable. I adored her, and she completed me. But years later, when she cheated on me with a fitness instructor and moved out, I took the decision to cut back. Footnote. First up, I resolved not to tell her things in person. Brackets, not that I've seen her since, but if I had, believe me, I would have told that which the square root of F all. Ditto on phone calls. Again, not been any, but wouldn't have said anything if they had. It was different with letters, because obviously I'd be sending those pretty regularly to beg that she came back to me. In truth, of course, the joke was actually on her. It may have appeared that I was bearing my soul, and that I had to keep starting again because the tears were smudging the ink, but in fact I wasn't that bothered about winning her back. I was only really doing it because, unbeknownst to her, cohabiting worked out better for me from a tax point of view. In the end, she didn't return to me, but that's not really relevant. Yet sitting here next to this sage old tramp, I feel there's something mystical going on. I almost want to say ethereal, but I have to check its exact definition first. Here I am, or here I be, in pirate speak, in a foreign environment in the dead of night, seemingly detached from place and time, and I feel I can tell Brian anything. We talk long into the night, me about my father, he about his, passing the bottle of sherry back and forth like it's a speak ball. Footnote. Speak ball is an American counselling technique devised originally in correctional facilities and Jewish summer camps, in which a ball is passed back and forth between the offenders slash teenagers to determine who should speak. It's a hugely effective and fun way to get youngsters and or violent sex offenders to really open up. Possession of the ball gives the chat much-needed structure, whilst the gentle toss and catch makes the activity feel like a sporty parlour game, delighting children and adults alike. He turns to face me, and for one terrifying moment I think he's going to kiss me. Instead, just as I'm about to slap him, he leans across and envelops me in a great big hug. I exhale loudly. I needed this. Yes, I'm a willing huggy, leaning further and further into the embrace, my face now buried deep in Brian's overcoat, which stinks no more and no less than I imagined it would. It's then that I realized he isn't hugging me. He's actually just leaning across to rifle through the bin. Remember, to a no-homer, bins are like supermarkets. We're in Gravesend, so it's likely to be more Morrisons than Waitrose, but, and this is lovely writing, beggars literally can't be choosers. With Brian distracted, I wipe away my tears. Not that I was crying particularly, but I wipe them away all the same. I think I hear him say the words, "I've hit the fucking jackpot here," and when he leans away from the bin, he's holding a pack of Jaffa cakes. They're past their best before date, and the chocolate's gone all ashen like E.T. does when he goes all ashen. But Brian doesn't mind. "Thanks for listening," I say. looking around the park, grateful to have found common ground on this piece of common ground. I didn't think anyone would be interested.
Are you kidding me?
Still managing to sound wise through a mouthful of mashed Jaffa.
What's more interesting than how our fathers shape us, and how we use that shape to shape the world? The journey you're going on, Alan. People write books about that.
Yes, and make TV shows. I laugh and tell him about Harvey Kennedy and his golden geese, Portillo Balding, Bradbury.
And why not Partridge?
He smiles. I smile and explain that, yes, for a while, honouring my father and making a television programme about it had been a flight of fancy I'd indulged. And yes, I'd gone as far as trumpeting it on BBC One's The One Show. Had he heard of The One Show? He hadn't heard of The One Show. But Harvey Kennedy wasn't contactable, slash lacked honour. So the footsteps of my father's television project was ironically as dead as the very father I was now focused on privately honouring. But by now Brian is on a roll. God, I love him. He seems to think it could easily be formatted up into a 6-part series in which I crisscross the country, recreating intensely personal journeys made by famous historical figures.
Walking in the footsteps of other people's fathers, as he puts it.
Bit sexist, but there you go. He's convinced that with a couple of days shooting, expansive external shots, with judicious use of voiceover, this walk could still be turned into the series opener. Describing it, and this is something I'm pretty sure I've never heard a homeless person say before, as proof of concept. He feels very strongly that it's in the same sweet spot as Portillo's Great British Railway Journeys or Canal Walks with Julia Bradbury, and he reminds me that Julia gets wonderfully remunerated. Although instead of saying the words wonderfully remunerated, he just says, Bradbury gets, then takes my phone and types out 3 pound symbols. Pound, pound, pound. I tell him he should be the BBC's commissioning editor for factual entertainment. He laughs, but I'm not even joking right now. Not that the Beeb deserves him. His wisdom would be wasted at Broadcasting House. He should fly himself out to India. I know he has almost no money, but BA do some good deals at this time of year, and Hindu holy men, who are basically just homeless fellas themselves, are widely revered. Maybe he could become one of them. I realise Brian's still talking.
At the very least, you should go see this Kennedy guy. If he said he was interested in your walk, you should follow it up.
Too late, I tell him. Besides, it's the start of a bank holiday weekend, Brian. Now, that won't mean a whole heap to you, but...
Turn up at his door, he suggests, like I do when I miss my kids.
I'm touched by his passion, even though I'm sure he's already told me he doesn't have any kids. And I tell him that if I were 20 years younger, I'd definitely have tried to pitch it. But after Harvey let me down and the whole Backshall mess... No, I tell him, I have different priorities these days, although I'm very tired now and can't recall what they are. Our conversation is at an end, and in a final act of quite staggering kindness, Brian offers me his bed, the bench, and lies down on the grass nearby. Night, Brian.
Sleep well, Alan. Swig a sherry?
Oh, no more drink for me, thanks.
No, I mean his mouthwash.
And with that he gargles the celebrated cooking liquor and blasts it from his mouth into a hedge.
Night-night.
What a guy. Chapter 23. The Curious Incident of the Shoe in the Night Time. Day 8. I awake, groggy, with a mouth as dry as my assistant's cake. Footnote, not a euphemism. I curse myself for drinking fortified wine. Who fortifies wine? It's one of the few drinks that requires no fortification. It already comes fortified. My hand ducks inside the waistband of my trouser for its morning scratch. Scrit, 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 and then away. I enjoy the sensation enormously. The first backside scratch of the day is always a treat, although I really should get it looked at. And eyes closed, I mumble out loud, scratching is fantastic. Oh, I open one eye and see some teenagers looking at me. I'd forgotten I was outside. I raise a hand apologetically and look for Brian, as the teens wander off, clearly in a hurry to fail their GCSEs. I spy Brian on the grass a few yards away, curled up. I grunt, Brian! Brian! Nothing. Brian! 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 Still nothing. Brian! 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 Still nothing. Brian!
Brian! Brian!
Anyway, this carries on for a while until I realise something. Brian isn't breathing. Like a cat on a hot tin bench, I leapt from my bench, bound over to him to try to spin him over, but his torso crumples and I realise that this isn't Brian at all. These are just his clothes. I sit there, utterly bamboozled. Where had he gone? And then another more profound thought. Was he ever even here? Perhaps Brian was merely an invention of my fortified, wine-addled mind. Perhaps in my drunkenness I'd been sitting here shooting the breeze with a pile of old, pissy clothes. Or maybe he was a road spirit. Some Native Americans believe weary travellers are visited by well-meaning spirits who provide guidance on the long, dark nights. I enjoy that thought and sit for a moment dwelling on it until I realise something. These aren't Brian's clothes. They're mine. I look round for the rest of the rucksack. It is gone. And I only bought it a week ago. I curse the gods until I realise something. I'm only wearing one boot. My sock quickly becomes sodden from the morning dew, and I hop around angrily until I realise something. The boot must have been stolen. I look heavenwards until I realise something. It must have been stolen by Brian. Yes. It seems Brian has made off with my bag, wallet, watch, and snacks. It's a pity. I hadn't told him this, but such was our connection last night. I'd intended to gift Brian a few £1,000 and find him work in television. Don't believe me? Well, that's up to you, Brian. But if you were here now, you'd see me looking you in the eyes. And not blinking, which proves it's the truth. Obviously that offer is now rescinded. But I hope you read this and realise what your selfishness has cost you. £10,000 in cash and a creative director position at Pear Tree Productions, complete with generous salary package, car, private healthcare and share options. And, as I say, that is true. Sounds like you chose pretty unwisely, amigo. But hey, enjoy the rucksack, Nature Valley snack bars and walking boot. While a lot of people, certainly those in my pub quiz team, think that vagrants are evil, I have always defended our hard-of-housing friends, and I'm not about to change that stance now. I just think it's sad that someone like Brian has betrayed the cause of his more noble colleagues, setting back perceptions of vagrancy by several decades and scotching any attempts by yours truly to persuade Cromwell's bitches and others that tramps are decent guys who need to be given a chance. And, as I say, I think that's a shame. I mean, why had he only taken one boot, for crying out loud? Spite? Forgetfulness? Perhaps he was startled and fled. I sometimes bark half-formed words in my sleep, such as, "Haw!" or "Stubborn!" Maybe he just wasn't able to remove the second boot, or had forgotten how laces work. I imagine him peering at the miniature shoe ropes, his tongue lolling from his stupid mouth before shrugging and walking away. Yes, Brian is a prized dolt, all right. And just my luck, he's taken the boot from my injured foot, causing the gash to reopen and blood to leak into my dewy sock. Either way, I don all of my remaining clothes and begin to walk on, having fashioned a boot from plastic carrier bags lined with slices of bread that have been left in the park for the ducks. Such improvisation is nothing new to me. I once spent a weekend trapped in a warehouse and managed to survive by fashioning a gown and cowl from bubble wrap and packing tape. That gown and cowl saved my life and felt pretty sassy as well. I still wear it round the house on Saturdays when I'm listening to records or vacuum cleaning. As I stride along in boot, bag and bread, I call my assistant to sound off. I tell her the news and she gives one of her non-committal grunts, a noise she produces when she knows she has to make a sound to register she's heard me, but can't think of anything to say. I carry on. And he had the nerve to suggest I should be trying to resurrect that Harvey Kennedy deal. "Huff," she proffers. "I know, like I'm going to take the advice off any Tom, Dick and Harry. I mean, what am I going to do, turn up at the guy's house?" She makes a less enthusiastic noise, which I know is because I said the word dick. She's unable to differentiate between proper nouns and swear words, which is why she refers to the well-known British garden bird as a blue chest. "Preposterous," I continue, "turning up at the guy's house." Silence. "Turning up at the guy's house?" I chuckle. Silence. "At the guy's house," I add. I walk on for a few seconds. "Do you think I should turn up at the guy's house?" This throws her. "What about the walk?" she asks. I sigh and explain to her very slowly, very simply, in terms that hopefully she'll understand, that footsteps of father's walks don't have to follow a precise route. They just have to be an approximation of the original journey. A minor detour to the house of an influential television and literary agent is hardly going to trash the meaning behind the journey. More than that, I say, playing my trump card, I believe it's what my father would have wanted. The raised inflection at the end of my sentence only slightly subtracting from its persuasiveness. I ask again, does she think I should turn up at the guy's house? And after an interminable period of her muttering and trying not to be drawn, I decided that one of her grunts, yiff, sounds enough like a yes for us to have agreed on my heading to the house of Harvey Kennedy for a chat about this exciting potential TV project. It's a shame, I say, I don't have his address and have no means of getting it, knowing full well that this slighting of her abilities as an executive assistant is one of the best ways to motivate her. I move the conversation onto other matters that do concern her, filing, replacing squeaky office chair, sacking cleaner, and hang up. And sure enough, a few minutes later, she texts me, 302 Elm Drive, Pinner, Middlesex, *X. I put the phone away, do a 180, point myself in the direction of Pinner, and walk, making surprisingly good time as my feet pound tarmac and white bread respectively. If you're not familiar with the geography of the southeast, imagine that London is a scowling face. I'm currently near the right jowl as we look at it. I guess Pinner would be up past the left eyebrow, which is to say it's not strictly on my way to Dungeness. It's more of a tight right angle or just over, and will require, what, 4 days of solid walking just to get there and back. But it'd be good to put the notion to rest once and for all, one way or the other. Good. Pinner nestles like a slumped dog between Ruislip, Northwood and Harrow. It takes its name from the River Pin, which wends its way through the village and whose banks are lined with anglers, or pinpricks, if, like me, you despise anglers. To get there will involve turning back and recrossing the Thames, which I'm happy to do. I set off with a spring in my step, yomping away at a considerable lick until, gah! A pain sears through me like jam syringed into a doughnut, me being the doughnut. The foot wound has opened up again after snagging on a sharp stick. The thin plastic skin of my carrier bag shoe no match for its jaggedness, and as for bread, well, it's been beaten so thin by my body weight, it's as if the sole of my foot is clad in damp communion wafer. It too is torn by stick, and as for my skin, well, it too is torn by stick. I bleed. I don't have time for this, and so I push on, leaking gouts of blood every time I put weight on the foot. It doesn't hurt, it just feels horrid as my bag shoe gets spattered with blood like a consumptive's hanky. Eventually it stops, the worst of the blood soaked up by pounded bread, now the width of graphene. Footnote. Look it up. Fascinating material. I get back onto the ferry. In next to no time, I'll be back in Tilbury, so I use the journey to bandage my foot in the men's lavatory with the age-old method of wrapping toilet paper round and round and round and round my injured foot until there are just 4 pieces of toilet paper left. If I've judged this right, that should be just enough to clean my backside after what I hope will be a straightforward ablution. And it is. The texture of stool exactly as firm and dry as I'd hoped. I could probably have done it in 3. With the toilet paper cylinder empty, I leave the toilet and nod at the man waiting for the cubicle, debating whether to inform him of the lack of toilet tissue. I dislike his facial expression immensely, so I decide not to bother, and after he's entered and shut the door, I smile as I hear the clack-clank of a hastily unbuckled belt. He'll find out the hard way. Once in Tilbury, I disembark and plunge Londonwards, the outline of its grey buildings muscling into the sky like a rude person's bag on an empty train seat, which you see a lot of in London. Anyway, the day consists of me walking again and trying to convince my assistant to wire some money to me, which I would collect at a branch of Western Union. She hangs up on me several times, convinced it's a scam, since the only time she previously wired money to Western Union was when she sunk £2,000 of her mother's inheritance into a friendship with a foreign correspondent by the name of Godfrey Tweed, who was eager to leave Lagos and come home to Norfolk to take lunch with her. The fact that his surname contained 3 E's and he spelt Norfolk, Nofroke, hadn't rung any alarm bells with her. But I knew that Muggins here would suffer the fallout when she did realise she'd been conned, so I ended up emailing Godfrey, threatening to call the police, and then with him off the scene, setting up a fake email account under his name and entering into a 6-month email correspondence with my own assistant. A staggeringly tedious exchange during which I/Godfrey let her down gently, promising to remember her always, and paid her back 2 grand from my own money, purely to spare me the grief of having a grumpy assistant moping about the place, believe me. I have to say the Godfrey emails were a wonderfully sustained and at times touching collection of dramatic writing that I unwisely printed out and kept, and that my assistant stumbled on one day after I asked her to dig out the manual for a juicer. Talk about hopping mad. Footnote. Kept the 2K though, didn't she? Anyway, it's now left her paranoid of Nigerian scammers and the money transfer industry in general. In the end, she drives into London so we can rendezvous at Stratford, where she winds down the window and hurls a holdall of cash at me without stopping, for reasons best known to herself. Whether you call it money, cash, or in the case of Dave Clifton, spondoolies, it feels good to have it plumping in my pocket once again. With it, I'm able to buy a fresh set of training shoes from Westfield Shopping Centre. What a shopping centre! What a shopping centre! And find accommodation in the Premier Inn there. I watch the King's speech on television and descend slowly into the dream state, i.e. go to sleep. Footnote. I used to go out with the girl who stammered, and this film reminded me of her, made me think I should have handled our relationship differently. Like the speech therapist in the film, my approach was very much tough love. Talk properly, I'd shout, or I'd demonstrate how straightforward speaking was for me. It was designed to inspire her, but her mum had a word with my mum, and I wasn't allowed to see her after that. Chapter 24. This chapter is quite short. Day 9. I pass through Stoke Newington and Crouch End, too pleased with themselves North London enclaves, where, in the words of Alan Titchmarsh, you could slap a stranger and feel sure they deserved it. Stopping on a bench near Hendon, I lunch on cocktail sausages and Scotch eggs, or sausage two-ways, as chefs round here would no doubt call them, and inspect my foot wound, peeling back the sock that clings to the gash like a toddler to its mummy. It looks pretty awful. The cut itself is neither deep nor long, but it looks like it could be edging in the direction of becoming infected. I smear it with antiseptic cream and hope for the best. I can't pretend the cut hasn't slowed me down. Setting off at 0900 hours, I had hoped to complete this cool 17-miler in around 8 hours, but when I arrive it's probably closer to 2000 hours, as in 8 p.m, rather than 2000 hours of walking, which would be crazy slow. No one walks that slow, not even Honeyford. And so it is that darkness has fallen by the time I walk up Elm Drive. It occurs to me that I should make myself presentable, since I'm certain to have built up a film of glistening sweat on my face, not to mention the black, pastry-like substance that gathers around the belt line. Crouching behind a Mitsubishi Shogun in a neighbour's drive, I pop my top off and wash my body with a bottle of Evian and a spare sock, all the while practising the smiles and nods that will hopefully show Harvey Kennedy that I'm an engaging and likeable presence. I discard the sock by forcing it into the soil of the Shogun owner's rose patch, and then finally, I'm ready. I walk up the driveway of 302. I knock. A woman answers. Hello. I was wondering if Harvey was around. I'm a friend. Sorry, Harvey's in Nice for work. Doesn't fly back into Gatwick until Tuesday night. Okay. After this nightmare on Elm Drive, although it isn't really a nightmare, it's absolutely fine, I make my way to the Tudor Something Hotel and sleep the sleep of the just. Some might suggest that Harvey's not being there has rendered the entire detour a total waste of time, but I disagree. I respect the opinion, I just don't agree with it. In the words of a Geordie man I once knew, worse things happen at sea, which in his case turned out to be chillingly accurate. Chapter 25. A Man Called Michael. Humility is my watchword, and I'm one of the humblest broadcasters you'll find. Of course, as a well-known broadcaster, people expect my life to be all lunch with Ranson, dinner and drinks with Dimbleby, lazy barbecues round at the Chegwins, and it's all those things, but I'm also a celebrity who, rightly or wrongly, befriends non-celebrities. In this chapter, I want to talk about one of them, Michael, a friend who is dead. Everyone knows a Michael, but probably not this one. He was an ordinary guy, an average Joe, a normal Peter. Footnote. My phrase. A standard Andrew. Footnote. Also mine. Perhaps those in Norwich might recall local papers prefixing his name with Cowardly Security Guard, or AWOL Guard, or Suicidal Geordie, or Shamed Scaredy Cat, after he stood down from his post to give a gunman free rein to terrorise North Norfolk Digital in a move that would go on to kill him. But to all intents and purposes, he was a nobody. Let's not dwell on their death, people say when a loved one has died. Let's celebrate their life. Well, with Michael, I'd rather do the opposite, because Michael's life didn't merit all that much celebration. He was an exceptionally low achiever, which I know isn't the be-all and end-all, but it's certainly the be-most and end-most. Let's face it, each of us knows someone like Michael, because there are Michaels all over Britain. Without likening him to a rat, it's fair to say that you're never more than a few feet from a Michael, and another similarity is that given the chance, he will breed like mad. A naturally promiscuous man, Michael once said that the only reason he didn't have a ton of bairns is because he sustained a cock injury in Iraq that rendered him infertile. Oh, but life was tough in the slums of Newcastle, where Michael was born to a tinker and an unskilled seamstress, one of nine children. Footnote. This is all conjecture or guesswork. We never spoke about his family, and I've never been able to find the time to look into it. The young Michael was told to leave school at nine and learn a trade. Footnote. Again, conjecture. He failed to do this, and at 16 he got talking to a couple of officers manning a join-the-army stand at a car exhibition at the NEC. Footnote. Conjecture. The kind who are down with the kids and lure them into conversation by saying things like, "Cool jeans you're wearing. You know what's even cooler? Firing guns." Many moons ago, back in 1969, the 5th Battalion was tough, and a fresh-faced young private would have been thrown in with some pretty rum individuals. This wasn't like the Scouts, where if an undesirable child joined, some of the other parents would get together and, purely to protect the good standing of the troop, go to see the Scout leader mob-handed and say, "If you don't remove that child, we'll be taking our children elsewhere." You simply couldn't do that in the army. In the event, Michael was posted to a few places and probably saw some action. It can be hard to tell for sure because ex-servicemen always insist they saw action, either because of post-traumatic stress disorder warping their memory, or because, as I say, they tend to be low achievers and it makes them feel important to say they fought. Cheeringly, Michael managed to find work as an odd job man at a reputable Linton hotel. Although some people who don't know anything about executive hotels think it's a motel just because you can see it from a dual carriageway and it's called a travel tavern, it actually bore more of the hallmarks of a top London boutique hotel, including 24-hour reception desk, complimentary shoe polisher near the lifts, which were also complimentary, and a savvy, discerning clientele who wanted five-star service for a three-star price. Although managers should avoid looking at TripAdvisor, where a handful of unhappy customers have absolutely gone to town on them. Here, an eager young Michael found work, glad to be back in a role where he was told what to do and got to wear a uniform each morning, albeit a pastel paisley waistcoat and cheap polyester trousers that went vip, vip, vip when he walked fast. And this is where Partridge comes in. I bumped into Michael at the bar one night. He was collecting ashtrays, then trying to use the discarded butts to make a super fag, a composite of other people's cast-offs. He was surprisingly adept at this, and I complimented him on his handiwork, even pretending to agree the super fag was mine if a superior came past and smelt the smoke. I watched as he chugged at it greedily, the paper along its length discoloured by lipstick and other men's spittle. And we started to chat. Me about work. Carol, my cars. Him about wanting to push his thumbs into his drill sergeant's eye sockets until he felt them pop. Eventually, Michael came to regard me as a firm friend, and although his lack of qualifications made it impossible for me to reciprocate, I did become kind of fond of the guy. Late into the night, we'd be at the hotel bar chatting about army/scout life, or sitting in quiet contemplation, or racing around the tables, seeing who could collect the most beer mats before reconvening at the bar to count them up like they did at the end of the Crystal Maze. Life moved on, I moved out, and it was only when a friend of mine won the franchise for a BP garage and wanted help that I spoke to Michael again. He took a job, and I'd see his face on the occasions when I'd pop him for coffee, fuel or chalk. "I'd never go there just to see Michael," I'd tell people. "That would be pathetic. No, I only ever go in there for coffee, fuel and chalk, and then I might stay there chatting for a while. But that's not why I go there. I go there for coffee, fuel or chalk." But the truth is that I did sometimes go there to see Michael and would only pretend I needed coffee, fuel or chalk because I wanted to talk about, I don't know, What happens if you put a grenade up an exhaust pipe? Or how I could go about having Sonia, my then girlfriend, deported. Why couldn't I just have been honest about it? Why couldn't I just tell him how I felt? What's wrong with a guy like me standing close to a guy like him and saying, Michael, I enjoy our chats, and yeah, I want to be with you? Nothing. Well, now it's too late. And that hurts like hackers. After the garage closed and was turned into a US-style car wash, Michael was out of work again. He refused to wash cars for a living because he said he had bad hands. I suspected this was a lie, and my suspicions were confirmed when he came to my house for Christmas dinner, and I watched him shucking sprouts in a colander with lithe, supple fingers and no little speed. It was so impressive, I cut the tip of my thumb while carving the turkey. Second time I've done it. Footnote. Try-hard friends of mine have started to snub turkey in favour of goose or duck, like they're in the 1850s. I'm surprised they don't have a clothes mangle and a pale aunt who coughs blood into a hanky. No, turkey is the best choice for a modern Christmas lunch. While high in sodium, it's rich source of protein, and typically a higher ratio of less fatty white meat to dark meat, around 70-30. The flesh also provides plenty of iron, zinc, potassium, and phosphorus, as well as selenium, which is essential for thyroid hormone metabolism. After lunch, I'll put the dirty crockery back onto the tray and leave it outside the front door for my assistant to collect. Regardless, he needed work, and I was in a position to help, so I agreed to vouch for him when the station, then called North Norfolk Digital, advertised for a security guard. Especially at a radio station, security is a skilled job. Each day the guard has to field visits from pop stars, salesmen, cold callers, angry listeners, and competition winners. The one thing he has to do is protect the security of the front door. As such, some people have argued that Michael failed in his duties. They go on to argue that he is ultimately responsible for the tragedy that led to the death of one person, Michael. Some have even suggested that he's not fit to wear the uniform, even though he bought and paid for it himself. Yes, it's almost as if they're saying that when Michael deserted his post to help himself to wine and mini sausages, unwittingly allowing a deranged gunman to enter the building and take 9 people hostage, he let himself down, he let the station down, and, as painful as it is to say, he let the 5th Battalion down, those still in it, and those who have given their lives fighting for their country. Or that's what some are saying. I'm pleased to say that I'm not one of them, even though I'd vouched for him to get the job and he was kind of throwing it back in my face. No, I'm pretty zen about the whole affair. Umpteen hours passed and a lot of other things happened, and then, for reasons never fully explained, we boarded the roadshow bus, which was gathering dust in the basement, and set off for the coast, Farrell, Michael and me. Security guard or not, Michael had jumped at the chance to steal, or in his parlance, twock the bus. Twocking is a Newcastlean word for stealing, an acronym for taking without consent. It says something about the Geordie people that taking without consent is such a central part of their lexicon that they've grown tired of having to say it, and in a bid to save time, have rendered it an acronym. The drive took us north to Cromer Pier, where perhaps in an heroic attempt to cause a distraction, or more likely, a less heroic attempt to sidestep the blame he'd shoulder at a subsequent inquest, or simply out of shame for heaping ignominy on the 5th Battalion name, Michael threw himself from the pier into the sea. It was the last time he was seen alive. Later that year, with his remains yet to wash up, Michael was declared dead in absentia by a local coroner. His funeral that week was sparsely attended, but I was only too happy to honour him. Like many funerals, there was a bugler there who was okay, I guess. You don't come to a funeral and start reviewing the musicianship, but there was an unspoken agreement, certainly among the mourners I made eye contact with, that he was quite a weak player. High notes fell strangulated, his pursed lips were over-salivating so that you could hear spit gathering around the mouthpiece, and I thought his rhythm was off. I kept nodding at him at the start of each bar, but he failed to take my cue. He also pulled quite a funny face, which I know a lot of trumpeters do, from Roy Castle to the black chap who sang that song on a Guinness advert once. But this guy's was really stupid. He looked ridiculous. Anyway, he was only about 13, part of the combined cadet force at a local school, so maybe he'll grow out of it. Looking to be helpful, I pushed up the sleeves of my jacket and began bulldozing armloads of earth into the grave, only stopping when I was reminded that Michael had no grave as he'd never been found, and that the earth nearby had only been dug up to make a rockery. It's been suggested by some that I was unconsciously repeating the actions I'd taken at my father's funeral, and this was classic behaviour of someone who had failed to deal with past emotional trauma. with this new episode bearing all the hallmarks of a man struggling to deal with grief, allowing himself to slip into a behavioural loop in a subconscious quest for closure. I have a lot of time for psychologists, but this transparent mumbo-jumbo does them no favours and sets their profession back 50 years or more. Behavioural loop, I ask you. As I've said, I was merely trying to be helpful, and it was a cheap shirt anyway, so I didn't mind caking it with dirt. Not that I'm sad. Verily, we all grieve in our own way. I like to drive fast round a Tesco car park and or eat Pringles instead of an evening meal, but it's much harder to move on when the dead guy hasn't been found and laid to rest. I sometimes picture his body all bloated and barnacled, his eyes staring, and try to imagine where he is, bobbing around the opening of the marine outfall pipe off the coast of Hull, say, or wedged between a fleet of out-of-season pedalos in the Solent. But on other days I imagine that he survived, and I wonder about his new exciting double life, working as a croupier in a casino in New Orleans, perhaps, or maintaining a fleet of out-of-season pedalos in the Solent. Either he's alive or dead. I just wish I could know for sure which one it is. I long to be able to send him a message, to reach out. You'll notice that the first letters of each paragraph in this chapter spell, "Hello, Michael, are you still alive?" Struggled a bit with the V. I can see, thinking about it, that there's no real benefit to sending him coded messages, as I'm not the one who's living a secret life, but I shan't go back and undo it now. All I'll say is, Michael, if you are out there, send me a sign. Maybe we could meet and talk about armored vehicles. Yes, I should like that very much. Chapter 26, The Gatwick Candidate. At first light, 10 a.m., it's up and off and on my way. The most direct route back to my father's footsteps would be back the way I came, walking as the crow flies towards the Tilbury ferry port and on. But I'm not a crow, I'm a partridge, and so crucially was my father. A partridge flies a little differently, often journeying south at this time of year, before a sweeping parabola takes it in an easterly direction. If I do that, and I am a partridge, I'd pass through the Gatwick area before making my way southeast to Dungeness. So it's really not that weird if I stop at the airport to see if I can have a chat with Harvey Kennedy. That's the way I'm heading anyway. I've also just remembered that I've been planning on entering the airport and checking out the Regis Express facilities for Yonks, which makes it even less weird for me to pop in. I've been a Regis customer for years now, and see the business services provider as a great fit for Brand Partridge. Because when you sign up to Regis, you're not just getting a desk and an Ethernet cable, you're getting a lifestyle. Impromptu meetings over piping hot machine coffees in the breakout area, shiny-shoed men with kick-ass PowerPoint skills, women in chunky-framed glasses sipping mineral water in front of an Apple Mac. These aren't just posed photos in the Regis brochure, although they are that too. These tableaux actually take place. Regis life is the very definition of business cool, and it's what I imagine it must be like working in Dubai. Footnote. I do have some insight into executive life in the Middle East after finding myself stuck on Richard Key's group email list following his departure from Sky Sports, brackets thanks to an unguarded piece of golf club banter, and his subsequent move to Al Jazeera in Doha. His weekly emails purported to be a way of keeping friends and family abreast of his new life in Qatar, but were actually thinly veiled bragathons in which he'd attach pictures of himself in sunglasses or making phone calls on a Lilo or eating steak with Andy Gray. Richard didn't know what BCC was, leaving each recipient publicly exposed as a friend of his, even if, like me, they'd only met him twice. Fortunately, I replied that it'd be fascinating to see how Richard got on in the Islamist state of Qatar. One is a medieval relic which despises women, persecutes workers, and is viewed with suspicion by the West, and the other is the Islamist state of Qatar. It seems I was removed from the list after that. Obviously, there are less sexy elements. An office neighbouring mine was occupied by a newly qualified chiropodist, so the entire corridor stank of feet. If you choose to terminate your office rental, Regis will hammer you on the small print, but the obvious solution is simply never leave. You'd be a fool to, anyway. No, it's a great business, and I've been looking forward to visiting the Gatwick Regis Express for some time. Yes, it is all falling into place beautifully. My journey takes me through the harrowing town of Harrow, the Greenbelt of Greenford, a woman called Brenda from Brentford, the Riches of Richmond, the Twits of Twickenham, the Teddy Boys of Teddington, and the Fit for a King, Kingston upon Thames, ending up in a modest B&B in the suburbs of Surbiton. If this sounds like a perfunctory description of the day's walk, or in the case of meeting Brenda, a lie, what can I say? Nothing of any interest happened. If you've got a problem with that, take it up with the towns I mentioned, or their elected representatives. The next day, so sue me, is largely the same again. Surbiton to Gatwick, just a pretty run-of-the-mill walk. I pause for breath and crisps near Reigate, and think of my father driving through this commuter town and appreciating the boxiness of Reigate Old Town Hall, a building of back-to-basics right angles. Yes, he'd have nodded warmly at the corners of this council-owned structure, since he despised buildings with rounded edges or swooped roofs. Yes, I bet he loved driving past Reigate Old Town Hall. And then I remember he didn't take this route. He'd have been way over the other side of London. Still, nice to think back. And so, 35 miles from Pinner, I arrive at Gatwick Airport. I love Gatwick Airport. Its elegant perimeter road, its state-of-the-art monorail system, its kerosene-stuffed aeroplanes soaring overhead like aluminium eagles. It's the London airport it's okay to like. Stansted, or Stansteed, or Stansteed, or Stansted, as it's variously known, is an arrogant upstart. City airport, full of bankers. London Luton isn't London, and it's barely in Luton. And Heathrow is just an absolute tit of an airport. No, Gatwick is the place to be. I take a moment to look at the transport hub that surrounds me. I don't just drink in its beauty, I actually feel like I eat it too. But what's this? Ah yes, the telltale thunder roar of a plane taking off. At first I struggle to hear myself think, but it's okay. I just turn up the volume in my mind. And then, almost instinctively, I find myself standing bolt upright, saluting the winged beast above me, and yelling up at it at the top of my voice, "Good luck, large friend! Take wing and fly, for the skies are yours now, and you are free, free to soar, to swoop, to glide and gamble across the very face of heaven until you touch down, weary yet elegant, in a land far, far away." And with that, Ryanair Flight 9853 to Cork is gone. I find the Regis Express, pay for a shower because I wish to be clean for Harvey, and inspect the facilities. They really are fantastic. Regis, of course, is Latin for kings, and you really can imagine the facility populated by historical monarchs from days gone by. Henry VIII gorging himself on the free tea and coffee, King Arthur booking a meeting room with a round table, King John using the state-of-the-art document station to scan, copy, and print copies of the Magna Carta, and Richard III just logging onto the Wi-Fi. And with that, it's time to head to arrivals. Harvey's plane from Nice isn't due until 8 p.m, but I want to be there for 6 because it's quite windy today, and I know that can reduce flight times. I stand by the taxi drivers with their little cardboard signs. Some of the more high-tech guys have got mini whiteboards that they just wipe clean after each job. It's a neat solution. I must save them a small fortune in cardboard costs. I decide to have a bit of banter with them. "Come on, boys, don't be tight. Give us one of your whiteboards." They laugh along politely, but I do actually want one of their whiteboards. If Harvey can't spot me among the arrivals' melee, we won't be able to talk turkey. Harvey loves turkey. Worse, we won't be able to talk about my potential TV show either. I've seen whiteboards identical to these for $2.99 on eBay, but the next day delivery isn't going to help me now, and that's why I'm more than happy to pay the slightly inflated asking price of Atif, a driver from Premier Cars. He looks like an Asian Alan Sugar, but is better at growing a beard. As I search for a pen for my £50 whiteboard, there's a sudden tap on my shoulder. I spin round, swivelling on the ball of my foot to avoid putting any pressure on my still-throbbing heel injury. It's DIY SOS's Nick Knowles, who comes to Gatwick Airport most evenings to drink, shop and eat. "Partridge," he says, and slaps my back. "Ha!" I laugh, not because it's funny, it isn't, it really hurts, but because I've always been afraid of Nick. He's a big man with a craggy face and an ease amongst labourers and tradesmen that suggests if the mood took him, he could summon them like Tarzan summons the animals and have them take you to pieces violence-wise. "Fuck are you doing here?" "Nothing, I'm just following in the footsteps of my father." "I was wondering why you were mincing like that." "Ha ha, lovely, no, Dad wasn't gay, or else I'd still just be a twinkle in his testes. Besides, I wasn't mincing, I was redistributing my weight to protect my heel gash." He looks at me. He really is a big chap, and his accent is a guttural East End oi oi that screams, "I am a physically violent man." I carry on. "And as I say, I'm on a personal journey to honour the memory of my late father. I'm just here to check out the Biz Lounge and have a quick word with someone."
Who?
Actually,
who?
He's not here yet.
I'll wait with you. Let's have a drink.
Nick leads the way to the Beehive, a Wetherspoons pub with views of arrivals, and orders a quick pint of lager for us both. What happens next is disappointing for everyone involved. Nick and I have two or three pints of lager. Nick says it will relax me and insists that he only ever presents DIY SOS if he's DIY SLOSHED. Sloshed. In the event, my dehydration, tiredness, and, let's be honest, inexperience with lager as a drink leads me rapidly into a world of very intense intoxication. A fact I only grasp when I spot Mr. Kennedy and try to stumble from my bar stool towards him. I reiterate my desire and Brian's desire for filming of my walk to begin ASAP, even suggesting it's my father's desire too, despite him being long-term dead. Ever the salesman, I go on to tell Harvey that alongside Bradbury, Balding and Portillo, I believe I can become the fourth jewel in his crown, although it seems that, as a result of lager, I actually say the fourth Jew in his crowd. It's at this point that my slick, if slightly loud, sales pitch is stopped in its tracks by Harvey placing a kindly hand on my shoulder. I should stress that the hand is one of his own. I instantly feel sick. I've misread the signals. It would be unedifying for me to go into too much detail over what happened next, but if you Google Oliver Reed's impromptu performance of Wild Thing on Michael Aspel's chat show, I'm told that it was almost exactly like that, down to the choice of song. I don't know why I felt it would be savvy of me to sing to the man instead of presenting my ideas in spoken form, as rehearsed repeatedly on the 100-odd miles from my Tilbury turnback, but that's what I did, and that's what I must now live with. Harvey, I'm told, tried to politely demur, suggesting we talk about it at a later date.
"We will talk about it now, Mr. Nichols," I told him, temporarily mistaking the TV agent for the high-end chain of department stores.
When he pushed past me, I screamed at my co-drinker,
"Plant one on him, Knowlesy! Lay him out!"
But Knowlesy didn't plant one on him, or lay him out. Instead, he pretended he wasn't with me. But that's Nick for you. He's basically a big, horrible git of a man.